spent a great deal of time last week talking about the first five verses or so in chapter 3. And there where Moses encounters the burning bush. We talked about the appearance of God there, or the appearance of the angel, and what that was, whether that was an angel or whether that was God. We're going to move on from that today, and we're going to continue on in verse 6. Before we do that, though, I've got a few books here. Next week, I'm going to be starting a young adults class downstairs. I don't know if there's anybody here today that would be in that class, but if there are, or if you know some and you want to get them, Certainly also dealing with the oppression, the evils of Egypt and what they had done to his people. And there's actually three things here. Yeah, Carol? Okay, so in verse 7 it says, I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt. I have heard their cry because of their taskmasters, and I know their sufferings. I just think it's interesting that it uses those three terms. I have seen their affliction, number one. I have heard their cries, number two. So there's two senses. They're right, seeing and hearing. And then also, I know their suffering. And so there's the knowledge of God that's involved here as well. So it's like it's all-encompassing. God knows exactly what's going on. He has listened to them. He has heard them. He's been watching them. They've never been without him, despite their suffering. Okay. So God is coming down to deliver them now because I think that their suffering is complete. That obviously the prophecy has been fulfilled that they would be sojourners for 400 years, and that in a land that was not their own. And he was ready to deliver his people because of their suffering. It reached this breaking point. It reached completion. He was going to keep his promise, and now was the time to do so according to prophecy. Again, going back to Genesis chapter 15 and verse 13. Genesis chapter 15 and verse 13, the Lord said to Abraham, Know for certain your offspring will be sojourners in a land that is not theirs, and be servants there, and they will be afflicted for 400 years. Well, it had been roughly 400 years at this point. It's going to be 430 years when they finally are delivered after the plagues. Yeah, and this is to show God's glory and his power. I mean, that's what God is showing, right? Yeah, God wants to show that he is powerful and we are not. He wants to deliver his people. He wants us to go to him and rely on him. And again, I think it's important that we do just that, which is make these things applicable to us, right? This isn't just about the Israelites. This story is about teaching us who God is. And what he's willing to do, what he is able to do. And so he is teaching us that he listens to the cries of his people and he cares about them and he's responsive to them. And so, yeah, God is going to come down and deliver his people because he loves them. And we have to be willing to make those cries, not to ourselves for our own deliverance, but to God. All right, question 15. To what kind of a land would God bring Israel? That's pretty simple, right? What does it say? It's flowing with milk and honey. That's a phrase we hear all the time. Flowing with milk and honey. Doesn't that sound pleasant? It's a good and broad land, further, is what he says. But more importantly, I think, what is that representative of? The fact that it's flowing with milk and honey. Yeah, blessing from God. What else? Okay, richly. It's a rich land. They're going to be richly provided for it. And I think the other thing about this is it's already flowing with milk and honey. When they go into the land, it's already set up. People have been living there. They're going to get into houses that they didn't build. They're going to take over vineyards that they didn't plant. All the stuff is already there waiting for them. So it's about the provision of God. What else? It's a good and broad land, right? So that means there's going to be plenty of room for all of them. And again, I think this is what I think that we need to see further here is this is representative of a paradise. It's representative of Eden, right? It's representative of heaven. It's representative of what of God's provision, of his providing for his people. It's representative of what God wants to have, how he wants to take care of his people, and how he wants them to have to rely on him. I'm reminded of when Jesus says, look, you know, I'm going to prepare a place for you. And in that place, there are many rooms. In other words, there's room for everybody. And if that weren't so, would I have told you that I was going to prepare a place for you? Well, in the same way that Jesus is preparing a place for us, so God had prepared a place for the people of Israel in the land of Canaan. Right? That was something he spent time doing, preparing that place for them to go and to inhabit it. And so, again, we need to remember that all these things that took place in the Old Covenant are representative, are shadows of what's to come under the New Covenant. And so, this is not the perfection. It's not the ideal, but it's a picture, a representation of the ideal. Furthermore, it's a representation of rest. And that's another point that the Hebrew writer goes to great lengths to talk about in Hebrews chapter 3 and 4, where, of course, many of them would not enter that rest. But, you know, God brought them out into the wilderness in order to deliver them, but many of them rebelled. And so he says in chapter 3 of Hebrews, verse 11, as I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest. What was God trying to deliver them to? He was trying to deliver them into the land of Canaan that they might have rest. Rest from what? Suffering in Egypt, right? And so he says, take care, brethren, lest there be in any of you, again, we got to apply this to ourselves, an unbelieving heart leading you to fall away from the living God. All right, but then he goes on to say, I don't want to read all of this, but really goes on down through chapter 4 and verse 11. Chapter 3, verse 18, to whom did he swear they would not enter his rest but those who were disobedient? So we see they were unable to enter because of unbelief. We understand that the entire generation fell in the wilderness. Therefore, while the promise of entering his rest still stands, let us fear lest any of you should seem to have failed to reach it. In other words, don't follow their example. You know, don't suffer the same consequence. God offers you a rest. You have to take it. We believe, verse 3, for we who have believed enter that rest. And then again, God said, verse 5, they shall not enter my rest. It just goes all the way on down until verse 11. Let's pick up in verse 8 of chapter 4. For if Joshua had given them rest, God would not have spoken of another day later on. So then there remains a Sabbath rest for the people of God. For whoever has entered God's rest has also rested from his works as God did from his. Let us therefore strive to enter that rest so that no one may fall by the same sort of disobedience. So again, the Hebrew writer speaks of fear of them being delivered into the promised land. And he says, well, Joshua, he sort of gave them rest, but not really. If he had given them true rest, then God wouldn't have spoken of another one that was to come later on. And so that's, I think, another thing that the land is representative of. And just the fact that it's flowing with milk and honey means they were going to rest. They weren't really going to have to, you know, work that hard. There was already things there set up. It was bountiful. It was fruitful. It was fertile. All of these things because of God. And that's the key thing to remember. Yeah. They were in the land of Canaan as sojourners. Yeah, from sort of like South Canaan.
They were already in Canaan.
Right.
And so that's what I always thought.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob all dwelt in Canaan, except that they were such a small clan at that point that it was, they had faith that eventually God would, that their descendants would inherit that land. But they were already living there, and then they left to go into Egypt. But you're right. Yeah. Vern?
They were sojourners
there. Yeah.
They really didn't own it.
Right.
They
Yeah, I mean, you think about it, like, the only... Abraham bought a burial plot, right? He bought a cave. That's about it as far as what they actually owned that they could call theirs. But even that, I don't think he really considered to be. Well, not really. Well, I think Moses, I mean, Moses was there only there for 40 years. The others were there for longer than that. And plus, Moses was really further down south in the land of Midian. In any case. Sure. Yep.
So, in other words, there would have been famine in Canaan when they moved over to Egypt.
Yes.
So, Canaan had been all wonderful, but then they actually wanted to have a family.
Right. Well, I mean, that's what forced Jacob and his family to leave. Yeah.
I never
but, I mean, remember, it's been 400 years since then. It's a long period of time that passes.
Yeah.
You know, between Genesis and Exodus, and then even after the first, like, whatever, 7 or 12 verses of Exodus, and then after that, there's like another big, huge gap. So,
you know, it's just how it's talking about this little detail because it doesn't have to bring in the need that transpired.
Yeah, I mean, at the first 7 verses, it talks about, you know, the sons of Israel who came into Egypt. And then Joseph died, and the people were fruitful. And then verse 8, it says, now there arose a new king over Egypt who didn't know Joseph. Well, there's a gap of like almost 400 years between verse 7 and 8.
Right, and I didn't realize that.
Yeah. So it's hard. You got to, it's hard to, because when you just read it, it's just. Yeah. Yeah. Yep. All right, and so that leads well to the next question. Vern, do you have. Okay. Yeah, that leads well into question 16, which says, what peoples would be displaced from the promised land by Israel? And this is from verse 8. Yeah. Yeah.
They're all Canaanized.
So there's just different subsections. Yep, Tyre and Sidon. So Sidon is named after them as well. Yep, exactly. And what's interesting about that, okay, so it says the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. That's specifically what's named in verse 7. Now, those are all descendants of Canaan. They're all related. Now, I think what's interesting is that these are cursed people. And this goes all the way back to Genesis chapter 9. In Genesis chapter 9 and verse 18, it says, the sons of Noah who went forth from the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And specifically, he notes, Ham was the father of Canaan. All right, so that's an important, you know, the reason that's there is, as sort of a footnote is this is going to be important later on. And then it says in verses, let's see, 24 through 26, After Noah gets drunk, his son finds him lying there in his tent. And then it says, Noah awoke from his wine and knew what his youngest son had done to him. That is, Ham. Obviously, Canaan has already been born at this point because he says, then cursed be Canaan. So he curses Ham's son because of what Ham did. A servant of servants shall he be to his brothers. Blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant. Okay, well, the Hebrews come from Shem. And so Canaan is going to serve the descendant. The descendants of Canaan are going to serve the descendants of Shem. All right, and so this is where this all starts in a way. All right, and then you get to chapter 10, verses 15 through 19. And it says, again, Canaan fathered Sidon, his firstborn, and Heth, and now the Jebusites, the Amorites, the Girgashites, Hivites, Arkites, Sinites, Arvidites, Zimmerites, Hamathites. Afterward, the clans of the Canaanites dispersed. All right, and so there's several of these names here should be familiar to you. They should sound familiar because they're repeated there in what we just read in Exodus chapter 3. So it's the same people, and they've dispersed from there. And then finally, chapter 15, verses 18 through 20 of Genesis. On that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, to your offspring, I give this land. That is the land of Canaan. The land of the great river, Euphrates, the land of the Kenites, Kenizzites, Kadmonites, the Hittites, Perizzites, Rephaim, which is Egyptian, Amorites, Canaanites, Girgashites, and Jebusites. So all these names get enumerated, and these are the lands that are going to be taken over. And this goes all the way back to Genesis chapter 9. So this is fulfillment of prophecy here. Again, this is about God keeping the promises that he gave to his, to the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, 600 years earlier. Is about this very specific area of land that they were going to inherit. Okay, question 17. What has compelled God to action for his people? Kind of talked about this already. I mean, he has heard their cry. Right? Their cry has come to him. It's the oppression of the Egyptians. It's the fact that God wants to keep his covenant. And it's also, I think, about his compassion. In his mercy, again, in verse 9, it says, now behold, the cry of the people has come to me, and I've also seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppressed them. So God has compassion and mercy upon his people. These people were his children, and he cares about them just as we care about our children. All right, so that moves God to action on their behalf. Yeah, timing as well certainly had a great part to do with it. All right, question 18. What does God call Moses to do? All right, go to Egypt, go to Pharaoh, bring the people out of bondage. Now, why? Well, I mean, yeah. Yeah. Okay, it's fulfillment of promises, but, I think... these aren't my questions, so I'm not always sure exactly what he's asking. But one thing that I went to in my mind when I was thinking about this was that God usually works through human hands. God could have very easily figured out another way to deliver the people out of bondage, and yet he chose Moses to be his messenger, to go down to do this, to put a human face and human hands to this work. And Moses was going to be that guy. God usually works through human hands. They needed a deliverer. And specifically, they needed a shepherd. And God chose a shepherd. And so he needed somebody that was going to be able to lead them out in the wilderness, that was going to be able to protect them, that was not going to be afraid. And that's exactly who Moses was, even though he didn't really see it in himself. And so, that's kind of where my mind went to. Obviously, yeah, God called Moses to do this because he was going to keep his promises, but he also called Moses to do this because I think God needed somebody like Moses. Okay, that gets us to the next section of verses 11 through 22 Unless anybody has any further comments on like question 17 or 18. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, he's been preparing him for this his entire life. Yeah. Yeah, he called him, he called Moses specifically because Moses had been being groomed for this, you know, from the time he was born. I think that's why he was that beautiful child that is, you know, was able to, that his mother wasn't willing to obey the commands of Pharaoh. Why the daughter of Pharaoh saw him and was willing to take him and take care of him in her own home. I mean, all of these things are because of the providence of God and God having a plan for Moses in his life. Well, again, sometimes it takes extraordinary events for us to see, you know, the abilities that we have and the things that God has planned for us. You know, and how many of us really have the confidence that we should have to use the blessings that God has given us? Right.
And if God told any of us specifically, yeah, you can do it, you're going to do it, we've done well.
You know, it took him some coaxing, but eventually he got there. There you go. Yeah. Yeah. I'd be afraid. I wouldn't want to face Carolyn in the night.
They found her in the bedroom with her clothes off.
Joe? Yeah, certainly that's part of it as well. Lynn?
We've got to go back to Martha Dan's Martha's Fallen.
Oh, no. Okay. All right. And that, I think that leads really well into the next section, which is, you know, where Moses starts questioning himself, you know. And in verse 11, he says, Moses says to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the children of Israel out of Egypt? All right, so that was Moses' first question to God. Question number 19, what was God's reassurance then to Moses? Yeah. Right? I don't know. You sure want me to go back there?
Or I can think of 17 instances that I don't wonder why he picks those people.
Yeah. Yeah, his exile is not just for any reason, right? It's for murder. You know, it's like if he goes back, you know, it's like, well, aren't they going to arrest me? Like, don't they know what I've done?
I mean, just think about what am I going to hold on to? What am I going to have?
Yeah, and I think it's, you know, when Moses says, who am I? He's right to say, who am I?
Right.
You know, and I think sometimes we look down on Moses because, oh, well, you know, he should have had confidence to just immediately go and do what God said because look at, you know, Abraham, you know. Well, okay, you know, but how many of us would have that confidence, for number one? And number two, every single one of us should say, who am I to do this? Who am I to serve, in, you know, to serve in God's place? Like, I'm not worthy. Every single one of us should say that. And so he's right to ask that question. But I think what's important is that that question led to God's answer. And God's answer was what? I will be with you. And this will be the sign for you that I have sent you. When you've brought the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God on this mountain. So God is saying, in other words, well, it's not you, it's me. You know, it's not about you, Moses. It's not about who you are, how powerful you are, that you have all these abilities that you're just going to persuade Pharaoh and you're going to show him your power. No, it's about me. I'm going to be the one to do the delivering. You're just my mouthpiece, right? And so God is saying, it's not about you, it's me. God will be the one empowering him. And the mountain itself will serve as a sign after the fact that God was with him and that God would deliver on this promise. They would come and they would worship him on that mountain. All right? And so, yeah, let's see. He goes on down there. So after verse 12 and verse 13, Moses asks another question. He says, if I come to the people and say to them, and so now it's sort of like, okay, well, now you're like, well, you're making excuses, right? The God of your fathers has sent me to you. And they ask me, what is his name? What shall I say to them? Well, why would the people ask Moses, who is this God of our fathers that has sent you to us? Right, yeah, I mean, here they are. They've been inundated with Egyptian culture for 400 years, right? There's a chance that they've sort of kind of wandered away, that they've maybe forgotten a little bit about who the real God is, right? And so I think there's, number one, there's a possibility that they may have actually even forgotten it. They may have forgotten what God's name actually even was. The ESV Study Bible says on this, given the polytheism and pantheism of the surrounding Egyptian culture, it was essential to know the identity of the one true God. Further, in ancient cultures, to know the name of someone was to know something very essential about that person. And so what does God's name reveal about who he is? It reveals that he is eternal, that he is the one God. All right, Yahweh. And that's really where these questions go, and I think it's important. And so the people of Israel needed verification of the identity of God that was sending him, and therefore authority. It was God's identity that gave him authority and thus gave Moses authority. And so it's sort of like, they need to verify it. Okay, you're asking us to do something pretty major. Well, let's verify that this is coming from the right source before we follow this instruction. And that's a sensible question to ask.
So it's not the Israelites. I mean, it was the Israelites that he had to be faithful to. It was not the Egyptians. It was the
Right, so the Israelites, when Moses goes to the elders of the Israelites and says, hey, God has sent me to you to bring you out of bondage, the elders of the Israelites are going to ask Moses, who is this God that has sent you to us? Not at this point. No. This is who I am. This is what we're going to do. All right. So then, question 21: what is God's name, and what does it mean? His name is I Am. Okay, yeah, it's singular, first, and it's eternal, second. All right, oh, I mean, not in no particular order, just one and two, but it indicates I Am. It's the verb form that he in the Hebrew of to be, and it's not just like present. It's always has been, always will be, is the idea. And so his name is Yahweh. I am in English, or to be is the verb form of it. So this indicates, again, his unchanging and eternal nature, which I think really comes out when he says, I will be with you. And he's also pointing out to them, I have been with you. I have been watching over you this entire time. I've heard your cries. And so God is saying, when he even says his name, God is saying, I have been with you. I am with you. I am with you, and I will be with you, right? And so that's really just who God's name even is. It's very important in verifying, you know, that this is that they should follow these instructions. Vern? And so, the use of Lord goes back to the Septuagint. That's the Greek translators initially used the word Lord there in place where Yahweh was used, which in Greek is Kurios, which means Lord, right? And so anytime you see Lord in the New Testament, that's what you're reading. But for whatever, so let me just read the ESV comment on this. I think it kind of explains it really well. Says God reveals his name to be Yahweh, which in the Hebrew this is the consonants of, you know, YHWH, right? And it's what's interesting too is that, like, if you were to go and research on like Hebrew websites for Jewish scholars today, and if they're writing in their writings even still today, they will not write the name God. They will literally, reading it on their article on their website, it'll say G_D. They won't write the full name. Or if it's Yahweh, it'll be like Y_H_. Like, they won't write the whole thing. And so just they had a great respect for God's name, who he is. But anyway, it goes on to say, the three occurrences of I am in verse 14 all represent forms of the Hebrew verb that means to be, Hayah. And in each case are related to the divine name Yahweh, the Lord. The divine name Yahweh has suggested to scholars a range of likely nuances of meaning. Number one, that God is self-existent and therefore not dependent on anything else. Number two, that God is creator and sustainer of all that exists. Number three, that God is immutable in his being and character and thus not in the process of becoming something different from what he is, same yesterday, today, and forever, Hebrews 13:8. And four, that God is eternal in his existence. With each of these points, while each of these points is true of God, The main focus in this passage is on the Lord's promise to be with Moses and his people. The word translated "I am" can also be understood to be translated as "I will be." Given the context of Exodus 3:12, "I will be with you," the name Yahweh, the Lord, is also a clear reminder of God's promises to his people and of his help for them to fulfill their calling. In each of these cases, the personal name of God is revealed to Moses, expresses something essential about the attributes and character of God. All right, and so again, and then in verse 15, where it starts talking about the Lord, it says, modern translations keep Yahweh in English. The ESV follows the tradition of replacing Yahweh by the Lord with small capital letters. This practice goes back to the first Greek translation in the 3rd century B.C., the Septuagint, which renders Yahweh by Kyrios, which is what I was saying earlier. And so this links it with the New Testament, which calls Christ Lord, and there, of course, thereby identifying Jesus Christ with God. So anyway, just an important footnote there on why that kind of got changed, and when you see that Lord in all small caps, what that means and what word is there in the Hebrew, which is Yahweh. Okay.